right, so welcome to Tantra Tour, the heart of India.
That's Tantra guru Laura Handlers from the film Tantra Tourists. She's basically telling them how her tips for a better sex life can lead to spiritual enlightenment.
In Tantra, we use our sexual energy to fuel our bodies with our vital life force.
Well, at least if we can get the guys to go along.
For men, they're usually shooting it out. And when they shoot it out, it robs them of their vital life force. So in Tantra, men learn to experience their sexual energy internally, like women already naturally do.
Maybe I should be careful about throwing Lori under the bus too soon. As you'll hear from today's guest, the very excellent Dr. Jeffrey Kripal, the link between the esoteric and the erotic goes a lot deeper than we think. In this interview, Jeff and I not only talk about his new book, Secret Body, but also the role that academics are playing in this struggle we have over religion and spirituality. We talk about UFOs, of course, since Jeff has done some incredible work in this area. But the main focus of this interview is the connection between the esoteric and the erotic, the moral and the stuff that we maybe sometimes too quickly discard as being immoral.
Is there a hierarchical nature to consciousness? Because there sure as hell seems to be. I mean, that's what all the near-death experience research says. Research says. That's what the past lives research says. That's what the medium research says. It says there's a hierarchical structure to consciousness.
Sometimes people have profound, life-changing religious experiences in situations which are dangerous or deadly or traumatic, and that sometimes deeply charismatic spiritual teachers who can change people instantly with a touch or a look can also engage in abusive, sexually abusive, physically abusive behaviors. What I've seen over the years is people who want to say that it's all either pure light and happiness and love, or it's all nonsense. It's not real. And what I'm trying to plead for is actually it's messier than that. And sometimes we can have profound religious experiences in amoral or even immoral situations.
Stay with me. My interview with Dr. Jeffrey Kripal is up next on Skeptico. We're joined today by Rice University Professor of Philosophy and Religion, Dr. Jeffrey Kripal. Jeff has a new book out titled Secret Body, Erotic and Esoteric Currents in the History of Religions. And he's here to talk to us today about that and a bunch of other really cool stuff. Jeff, welcome. Welcome back. Thanks so much for joining me on Skeptico.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Alex. It's good to be back. It's been a while.
It has. It has. And you've done so much fantastic work between then and now. We were just chatting a little bit before the interview started, and I was relating to you that, you know, when I think of you, sometimes I'm reminded of the lesson I learned in my way back in my former life as a software entrepreneur, and that the goal was not just to sell software, but to reach the influencers. And if you reach the influencers, then the message would get out and you'd sell a bunch of stuff without a lot of advertising. And I was telling you, that's what I see in your work. I see a guy who's had a huge influence way beyond. I mean, you've sold books, don't get me wrong, but your influence is really big. And I think you're going to have a similar kind of influence with this latest book, Secret Body. But it's just really cool to reconnect with you and talk with you. So just thanks. You're such a generous spirit with a great contribution. Thanks so much for joining me.
No, I'm happy, and I'm always happy to hear that you think books are doing work in the world. I mean, it's a solo flight, you know, and it's very lonely, and it's not always apparent. And then suddenly it is apparent. So that's always hopeful.
So Jeff, just to recap for people, you are a professor of religion. You live and work in the buckle of the Bible Belt.
Yeah.
In Texas. And you've written a book, of course, on eroticism and religion. Of course, just what we'd expect from somebody from Houston. That works, right?
No, I've been writing about, well, the erotic stuff is really just half of the corpus, Alex. You've read the book.
But that's the theme that really is going to grab people. And let's face it, I mean, what's really wonderful about this book is people are familiar with some of your other works. And we're going to talk real briefly about those, just so in case people aren't. Authors of The Impossible, Mutants, and Mystics, The Supernatural, that you just wrote with Whitley Strieber a couple years ago. But they're familiar with that.
Yeah.
What this book is going to do is, and what it did for me, is you've left bits and pieces of the trail for how you got there before. But this really winds it together. And let's face it, this erotic component, as controversial and jarring as it will be initially for people, is really at the center of this spiritual journey that you've been on. I mean, right?
And that's what Secret Body really is. It's really a kind of a spiritual memoir that kind of ties all the six or seven books together and puts them between two covers. And that was the initial genesis of the book. Was I travel a lot and I lecture a lot, and everywhere I go, someone thinks that I've written a different book because they've just read one book. And they're always sort of partially right. I did write that particular book, but they don't see the bigger picture. And so I wanted to give people that bigger picture. And I knew I couldn't expect them to read all six or seven books, but I thought maybe they might read one book. And so here's that one book. It's everything you ever wanted to know about whatever it is, I think, again, between two covers. And it's very much dominated by the erotic, certainly for the first half of the book, which is this kind of sets all the dials, doesn't it? And then the second half of the book is probably what most of your listeners are more familiar with. It's the stuff on consciousness and the paranormal.
So, you know, I'd love to talk about all that. We'll talk about all that. But what I found interesting is this connection you're making with your own deep personal spiritual experience and connection with the erotic. And not in the way that people are going to think initially.
No.
But then how that propels you really into this other journey that you're on. And then almost the surprise, as I read the book, the surprise that you found that, like, wow, you mean that led me to this, and this is what people are really interested in? Well, okay, I can talk about that, but you need to know where I'm coming from, kind of thing.
I mean, what ties these things, two subjects together, the erotic and the esoteric, is the collapse of binaries and this idea that what we think of as separate, whether it's sexuality and spirituality or mind and matter, are really not separate.
The book being this autobiographical, very brave autobiographical thing, is a great introduction to these other books that you've written that people know about. Let's talk a little bit more about that connection and some of those things. I mean, let's get this clear. I mean, it's kind of, we just have to say it. I mean, so you're a straight man, you care about gender issues, and you talk in the book about homoerotic themes in religion and your own experience as a kid who grows up in Nebraska and is very, very spiritually inclined, winds up going to seminary and is suddenly surrounded by all these closeted gay men. And this kind of informs your worldview in a way that I think the book really captures wonderfully. And that is, it captures it in a couple of ways. One, you know, is this whole thing about what's going on with this erotic nature of spirituality. But the other thing I see you struggling with in the book, and it's something that I want to return to again and again in this interview, is just your kind of contempt with the bullshit, with just how ridiculous it is almost at the surface. I mean, you don't even have to dig more than a teaspoon deep into the dirt, and it's just full of bullshit. So hit those two for me.
Yeah, so, I mean, I did. I grew up in Nebraska in a farming community, and when I hit adolescence, I grew up, I had a kind of idyllic childhood. Kind of, my wife describes it as Mayberry, and there's a lot of truth to that. Since pretty much everything collapsed, I became extremely pious, and that manifested as me fasting. Like, if you would have asked 14-year-old Jeff why he's not eating, he would have said he was fasting to become a saint. And that was true. Those were my conscious motivations. But it pretty much destroyed all of my social life. It destroyed my athletic career. It created great stress. It eventually and the seminary where I was going to pursue becoming a monk. You know, I wanted to be a saint. But I wasn't eating still, even 6 or 7 years later. So I was essentially a walking skeleton by the time I was 19 or 20 years old. And the monks were extremely wise and psychological savvy. And so they put me into psychoanalysis with one of their own monks who was a trained psychoanalyst. It was astonishing. I began to have dreams almost immediately of things like these hugely bosomed, beautiful women offering me banana cream pies and milkshakes. And I just felt horrible in the dream. I couldn't take the milkshakes or the pies. And I didn't know why. And so the analyst would say, "Well, Jeff, what do you make of that dream?" And I was like, "I don't know. It's really weird. I don't know. But eventually, of course, what I landed on is that clearly my little psyche had connected food and sex, and it also connected food, sex, and mother, because all the food was milk based. And so I had repressed my sexuality, you know, at puberty or adolescence, and that suppression had created this intense piety and this desire to fast and to become a saint. But it had also was killing me. But once I realized what had happened psychologically on a kind of unconscious level, it was just like you turned the dials in me. Longer anorexic. I was like really, really hungry. I mean, I hadn't eaten for the most part in 6 or 7 years. So I just ate everything inside. I was so hungry. And I just, you know, my body came back. And of course, when the body comes back, sexuality comes back. And suddenly I was this, you know, 20-year-old young man with a body. But I was also straight. And I was living in a community, a religious community, in which most of the young men were gay, not in some kind of explicit way. They weren't having sex with each other. It was just they were trying to be celibate as well. But pretty much everybody there was gay. Made that into a life of the priesthood or holiness. And I wasn't. I didn't fit in. And I was just so struck. I was struck by two things in college. I was struck by my own fasting behavior and how I couldn't stop that, and how that was driven by psychosexual forces of which I was completely unaware. So I realized through that psychoanalysis that people could be doing things for reasons that they weren't aware of. That was just stunning to me. I was so stunned by that. And then I was stunned by the what the Catholic Church was teaching about homosexuality, which was really bad in the 1980s, and the internal life of the church or the community of which I was a part, which was in a very healthy and playful way gay. And so this discrepancy between the inside and the outside of my own religious tradition really shocked. Disturbed by homosexuality, I was morally disturbed by the church's teachings on homosexuality, which I could see were really hurting people. And one of my best friends actually tried to kill himself over this. So that was very upsetting to me as well. And so that became kind of the origin of my intellectual career, my intellectual vocation or calling, was to try to tease out how sexual orientation plays into religious vocation and how that manifests, particularly in mystical literature, which so much of which is deeply erotic. It's about the human being, at least in the Christian tradition, uniting with Christ, often in an erotic or sexual way. And so obviously that means something different for a gay man than it does for a straight man. And so that was the genesis of all of this, Alex. It was this struggle, essentially.
You know, but if I can add something there, one thing that's really interesting about your journey and this turn that it takes is it isn't just about the Christian tradition, right?
No.
Because you get in a whole heap of trouble
right. When
you go over to India and you apply that same
lens,
that same sensibility, and that same bravery. You know what I see in this book is someone who's been through hell, has put themselves through hell, you know, for whatever reason, but they've been through it and they're on the other side. And there's a certain bravery that you show and you've shown throughout your whole career that makes you just kind of walk into the fire. And you probably don't even know what's coming at the other end, but that's so you go over to India and those Hindus have not forgiven you by any means. And you just walk into a whole shitstorm over there because you have that same sensibility. Tell people who don't know, you know, a high-level sketch of what that whole thing was about.
Yeah, so that came later. That's why I didn't tell it yet. I mean, what happens is, find anywhere in the Christian mystical tradition an erotic mystical life that a straight man can participate in. You're always in love with a male deity. And you're always uniting with a male deity in Christian mysticism. So I thought I needed to go outside of the Christian tradition. So Hinduism looked really fascinating to me because there's all these goddesses. There's all these ways of being heterosexual that don't exist in the Christian tradition. And so I went to graduate school and I studied Indian languages for almost 12, 15 years, actually. And I end up writing my dissertation on a famous Hindu saint named Ramakrishna, who died in 1886 in Calcutta. And I was looking at the Bengali texts about his life and teachings and the English translations when they existed of those texts. And I was just showing how they were censored or Bowdlerized when they moved from the original Bengali to the English. And my book or my dissertation, Kali's Child, was very much about that in that censorship and how they censored out all of the sexual material, particularly what we call the tantric material. And it turned out that Ramakrishna himself was homoerotically inclined, very much like my experience in the seminary and down through the centuries. And so I just wrote about that because it seemed to me obvious and it seemed to me to be an important thing to try to understand. So that book came out in 1995, and it was almost immediately hailed in the academy as this amazing new book. But within about a year, it had been targeted by the Hindu nationalists, right, what we would think of as fundamentalists in the U.S., who had just come into power in New Delhi. And they targeted the book as a kind of way to increase their own political power. And there were two major ban movements on it. It was debated in parliament. There was a file created on me in the equivalent of the Indian CIA. I essentially became this harassed and targeted American scholar. That went on for about 7 years until I had enough and just left the field entirely. It still goes on to this day, though. Other scholars saying similar things are targeted to this day. There's been about a couple dozen American scholars and many, many more Indian scholars and journalists who are now being harassed and threatened, in some cases even killed. So this targeting of intellectuals, it in some ways started in the mid-90s, but it continues to this day. And that was my dissertation, Alex. That was my first book coming out of the block that received all of this praise, but then all of this.
Right. But at the same time, you're aware of the larger context that this fits in terms of our culture, in terms of politics, in terms of power, in terms of all these other things. So it's like, yeah, they were picking on you, and yeah, they were defending their religion, but it's a lot, it's trickier than that. And there's this whole thing of that I hope to talk about next in terms of some aspects of culture and spirituality and how it doesn't fit together no matter how you do it. So, you know, you want to, however you play it, it's not going to work. So here's what I want to do with this interview. One of the things I want to try and do is chunk things down, because I think sometimes I love, you know, I could sit here and talk to Jeff Kripal for 2 hours. We're only going to talk an hour, I promise you. But, you know, and inside baseball and a lot of this stuff, and it won't have a chance to reach people because it's all kind of glommed together. So I'm going to probably break this up into separate sections. And I have another section, another provocative kind of little title that I'm going to kind of hit you with. And let's talk about that for a minute. And I'm again talking with Dr. Jeff Kripal from Rice University, author of this new, very interesting book we're talking about, Secret Body, which you can see there on the screen. And we just had a really interesting chat about really how bravely autobiographical this book is and some of the things that he covers in it. So definitely check that out. But next, Jeff, what I want to talk about, you know, again, when I say brave, I mean, people get a sense for what I mean when, you know, the book is just says, hey, here's the problems with non-self-reflective Christians. And again, you know, pretty much got this right out of your book. So if you would, if you feel up to it, it's kind of throwing you right into the fire here. But again, let's talk about some of the tough stuff. And if you wouldn't mind maybe reading this excerpt from the book, and then we can talk a little bit about that. Is that okay?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. So this is the from a chapter in the book in which I'm struggling with essentially being an intellectual in our modern or contemporary American culture, university culture, and rural America. And it goes like this. I go home to rural Nebraska every year. For decades now, I've been deeply struck, if not emotionally wounded, by the immense moral abyss that separates my university community from the general culture of rural America. I am thinking of practices and ideals like self-reflexivity, historical consciousness, religious pluralism, gender equity, racial and sexual diversity, environmental sustainability, the importance of privileging empirical data and thoughtful debate over received opinion and blind propaganda, and above all, a secular public space that guarantees both freedom of and from religion.
Okay, you're punching pretty hard there. Do you want to elaborate at all on that?
Well, I mean, there's so much there we could elaborate on, Alex. Those things I just read off, those are in any basic mission statement or value statement of any university or college in the country for the most part. Certainly not all of them, but I would say most of them share all of those values. And yet those are the same values.
They profess to share those values. I am highly, highly doubtful that they really do. But okay, I'm with you.
Institutions I've worked in have. I mean, those we've nurture and defend those values. But those same values are demeaned as liberal. I mean, liberal has become a bad word in our public culture. Even though it was a perfectly fine word 20 or 30 years ago. You know, I mean, we still speak of a liberal arts education. None of us in higher education think that's a bad thing, but that is a bad thing to huge swaths of rural America. And so I'm trying to put my finger on that problem, on that rip right through American culture. And
I'm not sure the rip is where you're putting it. I mean, it certainly is. I don't want to kind of get too, you know, just provocative for the sake of being provocative, because we get it. You know, we get what you're saying in terms of the fundy Christians, right? And the crazy Christians, and get all that. But we get that there's a lot of crazy atheists out there, and there's a lot of crazy liberals out there. And any side can go and get a little video of the craziness of the other side and show it out there. And all of a sudden, you know, it's just this kind of division. Let me tell you a little story from my life. You know, just this last weekend, I attended this funeral ceremony for kind of this soccer friend. So my daughter plays soccer and a soccer dad, you know, but I knew him pretty well and really nice guy. Really liked him. I go to this guy's funeral ceremony, celebration of life ceremony at this evangelical church in Southern California. So you live in the buckle of the Bible Belt. I live in liberal Southern California, and I'm in this evangelical church, and it is full, first of all. I mean, you're stunned by the fact that they can fill up a church with 400 people for somebody these days. You know, that doesn't happen on a Saturday afternoon. And they go through this guy's life, and it's an amazing life. It's a quietly amazing life of little things that he's done and helped people. And the two gay soccer moms who he initially meets by writing this letter saying, hey, you know, Proposition 9 is coming out for gay marriage, and we should really rally against this, you know, and it's terrible. And they kind of gently take offense. And this guy completely goes inside and says, you know what? I'm wrong. I'm wrong about that. You are really great people, and I need to reexamine what I believe. And he turns out to be this tremendous friend, like he was to so many people. And he helps these people out constantly. He's like their number one handyman, like perfect uncle that just does everything for him. The guy lived an amazing life. And I'm sitting in this church listening to a lot of evangelical bullshit that I can barely get through about empty tomb and about you better come over to our side and all the rest of this crap. But I'm struck by the fact that this guy, through all that, found a way to live and grow his spirituality in a way that we all would look at and go, that's a beautiful thing. So I don't know. You know, I get the anger at the crazy Christians and the non-self-reflective thing, but I just think the other side of that, that liberal side, the community that you're at, is so filled with ridiculous atheists, I am a biological robot in a meaningless universe kind of non-thinkers, non-self-reflective people as well. And I wonder which is worse, because my buddy in the evangelical church, he got it, and he got something out of that experience that, even though I don't know how he did it and I couldn't, there's something there that I don't think he could have gotten in the academy.
Yeah. Well, you're using a lot of words I would never use, Alex. You know, I don't talk about crazy Christians anywhere in the book.
No, I do. That's me. And I get called on for Christian bashing. But to me, it's just, you got to look for the truth, you know? So, but yeah. is the historical Jesus real? How much of that is a cult thing? All that. But I'm sorry, please continue.
Yeah, I think what you just articulated is frankly part of the problem. It's a false equivalency. You can always find examples on any side that are extreme and easy to make fun of. But I think it's a false equivalency to point to the kind of far right-wing propaganda that really controls so much of our public conversation today and higher education, which is really about having conversations. And yes, there are excessive moments in higher education, but it's really not the same thing at all. So I don't see that, frankly, from where I sit. I think we need a lot more calmness, and we need to talk about these things. And that's what I'm trying to do in the book. I'm trying to call out where I think the split is. And I'm calling on intellectuals like myself to not just talk to each other, but to go out into the public culture and talk to their families, talk to the public culture about what it is we do in higher education, which I think is really still the answer. And I think this lack of civil discourse and this constant demonizing of the other is precisely what we don't do in higher education in our best moments.
Okay, with that, another point from the book that you might want to talk about. Nothing positive in the humanities. Boring. That's clipped right out of the book. You need to give it some context. So please give it the context, because that's really my rub and another one as well. But please tell me what you're thinking with that.
Right. So that's actually a great thing to follow up on our previous conversation, because your listeners might think that I'm just rah-rahing for higher education, and I'm not. I mean, much of the book is a pretty robust criticism of my own people, you know, the humanities, the people who work in the humanities. And the argument there that you referenced very briefly is, I basically make this argument that if you want to be taken seriously in the humanities today, it has to be depressing. In other words, it has to be deconstructive in some ways. You can't really say anything positive or constructive.
I like how you say then, if you think I'm wrong, try it. Say something.
Yeah. And, you know, the argument in the book is that the humanities could be very much about our own cosmic nature. I'm really pushing for a kind of cosmic vision of the humanities, with the human being as this highly evolved expression of the whole universe. But I'm also struggling with what I know to be the case, that you can't really say that in our present intellectual climate without getting essentially cut down, your knees cut out from under you. So I'm certainly not romanticizing the higher education. I'm actually deeply critical of it. And I'm trying to address what I see as the faults there, as well as the faults of the public culture.
I'm not sure you're critical enough, and I'm not sure you're critical enough in the ways that I would be critical. You know, Gloria Steinem and her connection to the CIA, which has been outed, she outed herself, I think is a classic example of how we can easily kind of be misdirected here. Look at the dialogue that created. Most of it from people in your camp, if you will, was, oh, Gloria, you know, she shouldn't have partnered with the CIA, but I guess she had to because feminism was so important. And I say, fuck that. I ask the question, what the hell is the CIA doing shaping culture? And why would you so blindly follow because you think it fits with what your agenda is? Can you really be that easily manipulated? I'm not talking about you directly here, but as a group, can you really be that easily won over and say, oh, but we had to win feminism, so it's okay that we partnered with the CIA to do it. It's, oh, you know, it's like I say, the whole intellectual thing, you know, curb your fucking indignation. Where were you when Obama became the drone strike president that killed more innocent people at funerals and weddings than anyone in history? Where were you? You know, where were you when 9/11? Where were you folks with all the rest of that? But all of a sudden, there's all this indignation at the social injustice. Is the social injustice new? Is this somehow a new phenomenon that we have to worry about? I wonder about that, and I wonder about how much they've bought into this blind materialism that we talk about, that I talk about, biological robots in a meaningless universe, and how much that is never fully brought up and examined. You're certainly examining it. You're certainly coming at it from a completely different angle. But I wonder if your audience inside the academy is really up to speed on that, or if they're just going, yada, 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 now let me get on with my
Again, Alex, you put a lot of things on the table there. I, of course, I didn't address Gloria Steinem in any way in the book. So again, you can pull out these examples from any position.
Well, address it now. Gloria Steinem was a lifetime CIA operative, and the feminist movement was highly influenced by what the CIA wanted to do. Isn't that relevant to what we're just talking about?
Yeah, but I don't know anything about it. So the first rule of trying to say something intelligent is that you don't say things about something you don't know anything about. So I just don't know anything about that case. But I'm sure there are lots of instances in which, you know, the intelligence services influenced the intellectuals. I mean, much of science, of course, is wedded to the military complex as well. There's all kinds of things we could talk about there. But none of them are addressed in this particular book. And I don't know a lot about all of that stuff. But I mean, you're certainly right that I'm not whitewashing all intellectuals or all of higher education. That's not what the book is about. It's a plea to look at religion and look at human nature in a way that is not simply reductive, but it's also not bound to our religious categories that we inherited from the past. You know, that's really what the book is about. So, you know, I share your critique of materialism. You know that. You know, the book engages in the same critique of materialism that you just articulated. I don't speak of things I don't know anything about. That seems foolish.
Okay, let me ask you, do you think we should talk about morality? You have an interesting little, just one line in the book that I think is, we could talk a lot about, and that is, you say you're reluctant to link the mystical and the moral. And one of the things that I think is interesting about that, from where I sit, having done all these shows on, for example, near-death experience, the underlying question seems to be, okay, if we get to the point where we accept that we're in a post-materialistic world and that there's this extended consciousness realm, which you accept as kind of a given in your work,
right,
then don't we have to ask the next question, is there a hierarchical nature to consciousness? Because there sure as hell seems to be. I mean, that's what all the near-death experience research says. That's what the past lives research says. That's what the medium research says. It says there's a hierarchical structure to consciousness. If there is, then I think this question that I just teed up, you know, is religion moral? Is God moral? And your reluctance to connect the moral and the mystical, I don't know. I want to throw that on the table. And in the spirit of having a good debate with you, Jeff, because as you know, as we said, I so respect what you're bringing to this conversation, but I got to push you a little bit because these are the things that I care about. And because we need to model, I think, that there needs to be a dialogue that isn't always two people patting each other on the back and agreeing about everything.
Yeah. Oh, that's fine. I think it's a great question, Alex. We could address it.
Please go ahead.
Well, so you're referring to one of there's 20 what I call gnomons, and these are like little short phrases that summarize basically the different ideas in the book. And one of the early ones, connection between the mystical and the moral. And that's a very complex statement. But what I mean by that is sometimes people have profound life-changing religious experiences in situations which are dangerous or deadly or traumatic. And that sometimes deeply charismatic spiritual teachers who can change people instantly with a touch or a look can also engage in abusive, sexually abusive, physically abusive behaviors. And what I've seen over the years is people who want to say that it's all either pure light and happiness and love, or it's all nonsense. It's not real. And what I'm trying to plead for is actually it's messier than that. And sometimes we can have profound religious experiences in amoral or even immoral situations. And it's just an observation I'm making. It's not a moral claim that Jeff Kripal's making. I consider myself to be very concerned about moral issues. I'm a social persona. I'm a citizen. I'm a family member like the rest of us. So I care about people, but I don't then draw from that every single religious experience has to somehow honor those moral codes, because they clearly don't. And if you look at religious experience historically, what you realize very fairly quickly is that what human beings have experienced as holy is not the same as the good or the moral. That sometimes when someone has an encounter with the holy, it's terrifying and it's even potentially deadly. You don't get to look on the face of God. You don't get to touch the Ark of the Covenant. If you get too close to this God, you die. So clearly the holy there is not what we think of as the good. It's something way beyond that. It's something way beyond any moral category, and it can manifest in terrifying or very redemptive and healing ways. So let me bring this back to a single example. So I, as you know, I'm really interested in the abduction literature and this phenomenon of modern people having these abduction experiences. Well, some of those abduction experiences are very positive and redemptive and healing, and some of them are terrifying and traumatizing and destructive. And I would say they are both of those kinds of abduction experiences are encounters with the holy, one in a positive frame and one in a negative frame. And I wouldn't want to, what I'm trying to argue against is saying, oh, one is demonic and one is real. No, the demon and the angel are two sides of the same sacred coin here. And we have to struggle with that as human beings, because this is our religious experience over the centuries and millennia. We can find hundreds and thousands of cases of religious encounters that are incredibly positive, and we can find the same number that are incredibly negative. So why lop off one for the sake of the other? Why not just say they're both there?
Because we don't know. Because we don't know if some of those really horrific abduction experiences are at the hand of some MyLab military industrial complex idiot who's doing some other mindless MK Ultra type job. And then there's a whole other set of them that truly are spiritually transformative because that was the intent of the people behind them. We don't know. So just in the same way that we can't apply, you know, the filter that you just kind of criticized, we can't apply your filter either, because we don't know what the nature of those
things. Well, but we know that any religious experience before 1920, or just pick your date, had nothing to do with an MK Ultra lab or any intelligence service. I mean, you can see these patterns as far as you want to go back in time. I mean, these are deep, deep historical patterns. I don't buy your critique there. I mean, I think these are ancient. And they say something about our own humanity and how it interacts with whatever that is that we're interacting with.
I want to try and hit one more point before I let you go onto your busy day.
Okay.
You're so incredibly generous for sharing this time with us and sharing with so many people your insights and your perspective about this new book, Secret Body, which is, as we've touched on a little bit, but I've pulled you in a lot of different directions, but it's about this journey that you've been on. It's a memoir. It's a celebration for people to understand really your whole body of work through these experiences that you've had and the connection between the erotic, the esoteric, and religion. But as you can see on the screen, the last topic that I want to talk about is something that you just led us into in this last section. Because again, Jeff, I don't quite
agree with you. You know, I just had, this is your kind of famous, if you will, this is another influencer, Jeff Kripal influencer, where you'll hear this over and over again, and we need better sci-fi to understand UFOs. That's Jeff Kripal. If you hear anything like that in any form or fashion, that's Jeff Kripal talking. But, you know, recently I had the opportunity to talk with both Jacques Vallée, who's kind of come around and done some interviews again. And I also had a chance to interview Stanton Friedman. And I interviewed Stanton Friedman. I wanted to really interview him because I think there's this contrast where everyone says, oh, Jacques Vallée. You know, Jacques Vallée's awesome. I love Jacques Vallée. But I was like, oh, Jacques Vallée, he understands this stuff. He understands consciousness. He understands that this is ancient and forever. And then Stan Friedman, of course, is characterized as this guy. Oh, he's an old nuts and bolts UFO guy, and he's just flying saucers and nuclear propulsion systems and all this. No. Go talk to them both. They're both saying the same damn thing. So Jacques Vallée is very interested in the crashes. He's very interested in MUFON still. You know, people say, oh, he doesn't care. Yeah, he cares about MUFON. He cares about the data that they're collecting. He cares about how to gather this information. He cares about the technology, what we've gained, what we've known and learned in the last 60 years. So he's broadened the discussion in the way that you're talking about in terms of this extended consciousness realm, and we don't know how it interacts. But I don't find him as willing as most people have characterized him to give up on the immediacy of the technology that is kind of coming out of that. And then on the flip side, you know, you have Stan Friedman, who, like I've always saw with Stan Friedman, he's always talked about consciousness, right? So he's talking about Betty and Barney Hill, the first major abduction case in the 50s. And he's saying, hey, it's all about consciousness, and they're doing all these consciousness things, and we have to factor that in. And we have to factor in the technology of consciousness and how much we don't understand it. So my pushback on you, Jeff, and what I'd like to hear you respond to, and I like pushing you because you push back hard, and that's how you should do it. I think you're overstating the UFO consciousness, Jacques Vallée, fairies and angels throughout history thing to the extent that it doesn't jive with the technology angle that we know exists from the last 50 years of recovering flying saucers and trying to reverse engineer them and doing all that stuff, which is now so much outed and in the news, and Tom DeLonge and, you know, all the rest of that stuff that we know now that stuff is there, and we're living through this kind of drip by drip disclosure. I'll shut up now. What do you think about the technology angle to this?
Well, again, this goes back to something I said earlier, that one of the first rules when you're trying to write a book or you're trying to be a responsible intellectual is you don't talk about things you don't know anything about.
No, you already played that card. You got to know about as much stuff as you can know about.
Well, no, I don't. I've never seen any hard, fast evidence for recovered technology.
So it is your opinion from the evidence you've seen, you do not believe that there's been any recovered technology.
No, I didn't say that.
I'm pinning you down. I'm asking you. You've been in this field. I mean, it's not like you've had your head buried in the sand. I think what you just said is you haven't found any evidence that convinces you that there's a reality to that. So you accept the kind of government-sanctioned opinion that there hasn't been any.
I don't have any security clearances, Alex. I haven't seen any of these objects. I have nothing. But Jeff,
we all have nothing. We've been pushed into a position of having nothing. No, we have to work with the data we have. We have to work with the information.
Here's what we have. We have people's experiences. We have lots of experiences. And that's what I do as a scholar of religion. I study people's experiences. So when I talk about the UFO phenomena, I don't talk about recovered craft because I don't know anything about it. I talk about people's experiences of abduction or sightings or encounters because those do, in fact, look just like the religious encounters in the past. And I can say something about that because that's my area. I actually can speak to that.
I'm shaking my head because I don't buy that, Jeff, in the sense that it changes everything if you push that to the end, it changes everything. It's like when we're talking about Christianity, you know, on this show, we've gotten very interested in biblical scholarship and the mythicist kind of idea about Jesus. It changes everything if when we come to one conclusion versus another about a historical Jesus. I think there's an exact parallel with UFOs. If you come down on the John Mack side and you say, this is real, these people are having abduction experiences, and they're spiritual in nature, that puts you in one camp. Right. If you come down on the David Jacobs side and you say, these are abductions in the abduction criminal sense of the word, and that it's a project being run by someone in control in that MK Ultra kind of world, then it puts a completely different filter on the experience.
I'm very suspicious of the invasion mythology and the whole thing you just articulated. It sounds too much to me like a paranoid kind of fundamentalist fantasy about extraterrestrial invasions. And I address that in the book, by the way, if you remember.
I didn't remember that part, but go ahead, tell us what you think.
I think those kinds of fears and phobias are essentially religious, and their fears of hybridity and their fears of the other and their fears of the religious other. And they get framed in these abduction experiences, which are real, by the way. People really have these abduction experiences. But that doesn't mean I think there are actual extraterrestrials invading the U.S. That sounds way too Cold War, way too fundamentalist to me to believe. And it's not my job as a scholar of religion to believe any mythology I run into. I don't believe any of it. I think all of these things are stories that cultures tell themselves at particular places in time to make sense of the world. But I don't believe any of the stories.
Well, I think liberalism is a story. I think feminism is a story, in particular when we find out that what feminism was really about was a project run by the CIA to control and shape culture. And I say that in the sense that we can all get behind and say, going back to the 1950s and treating women in this subservient role is completely unacceptable, but so is an engineered effort to shape culture in a particular way in order to control people. So
what I would say to that, Alex, first of all, people have been trying to control the cultural narrative forever. And you can blame the CIA today, but before that it was the Catholic Church or the Puritans or, you know, the Empire or the British colonialists or the East India Company. Human beings always try to control the narrative. And what I am as a scholar of religion is I'm always suspicious of the narratives, whatever they are, because I know they're controlled. That's my point. They're of course they're controlled. But it's not the evil CIA doing everything. It's human nature. Nation states do this. Bloggers like Alex do this. I mean, we all do this. We're all kind of arguing about what the narrative is. And I'm just like saying, hey, okay, let's wake up. Let's admit we're arguing about the story and let's tell a better story. That's the source of the quote you put up there earlier. This is why this is the better sci-fi line. We need better science fiction, not because one's true and one's false, but because, you know, we're living in a set of stories that are pretty nasty.
Our guest again has been the incomparable Dr. Jeffrey Kripal. You're going to want to check out his new book. If you're a fan at all of any of his prior work, you really want to add this book. For me and for a lot of folks, it'll just add such an enriched view of this whole body of work. It's been absolutely terrific having him on. If you've just tuned into this segment of the conversation, do check out. I plan on releasing this in a couple of different ways, both all together and in parts, so we can pull out some of the really interesting stuff that Jeff had to say. He kept saying I was pulling him away from the book. That's the point, Jeff. Everyone's going to go buy the book. We want to know what you're thinking about all these other issues, but you're terrific. I'm so honored to have you on and to have this kind of dialogue with you. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks, Alex. It was fun.
One of the things you know that I really admire about Dr. Jeff Kripal is that he's not afraid to walk through the fire. And in this Harvey Weinstein Pizzagate world that we live in, he certainly stepped into the fire with his thoughts on the links between the esoteric and the erotic. So the question that I tee up from this interview is the question that I teed up to Jeff. Can we talk about something like morality when it comes to the spiritual? Or is that another dimension that we can't touch and shouldn't try and apply our very human perception on what's going on there? I think you probably get the general gist of what I'm talking about since I talked about it quite a bit in this show. So let me know what you think on that. Of course, the place to do it is through Skeptiko website at skeptiko.com. I always encourage people to come to the Skeptiko forum, although we've had a little bit of a drop off in people that are showing up there. So come back over there. We'll have a conversation. But you can reach me also on YouTube. I'm putting out more YouTube videos, or on Facebook as well. We have hundreds of thousands of page views every month and thousands of downloads. So there's a vital community out there. They just don't talk enough. And I'd love to see them talk more. So if you're inclined, please do that. I have a number of interesting shows coming up. And I do have some videos from this interview that you just listened to. So look for those on YouTube as well. Well, that's going to do it for this episode of Skeptiko. Until next time, take care and bye for now.